and say about black holes. So there
you go. Thank you, Mr. Lover. Thank you for your invitation to do this seminar here, this interesting conference. And I will speak about, in particular, to the singularity problem at the quantum level, at also at the classical level, in the quantum gravity theory, or in some models, mini superspace model, quantized in a way described by true quantum gravity. So I wanted to introduce, before to apply the idea of quantum gravity to this particular model, I want to introduce the theory. And so the problem consists in three parts. In the first part, I will recall theory. In the second part, I will apply the ideas of quantum gravity to a mini superspace model. In particular, I will study the interior and the event horizon interior of a sparse black hole. And then I will give an explicit semi-classical solution or an explicit metric for the black hole that is suggested from this inspired quantum gravity approach to the problem. So first of all, I want to speak about, I want to recall what are the variables. And I call the ADM variable. The ADM variable are the metric of the spatial sections, and the conjugate momentum is the curvature, the extrinsic curvature of the spatial section. Then, by canonical transformation, we can obtain the Hachetegard variables, where the coordinate here is the Hachetegard connection on the spatial section, and the conjugate momentum is related to the triad I on the spatial section. Those you can read the standard Poisson bracket for the theory. Then we can express general relativity in terms of a set of constraints, the Gauss constraint, the Diff constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraints, and also in terms of the Hamilton equation of motion. In particular, to give an interpretation of the possible interpretation of the theory, we define the area and volume operator in the spatial section. So, what is the canonical approach to quantum gravity? To solve quantum gravity, we must solve the seven constraints, and so what we must do to find is an Hilbert space where all the constraints are satisfied. This is the problem. And I will do this in the very simple case of the mini superspace model when we study the black hole interior. The fundamental ingredient is the holonomy of the connection, and it is the exponent, it is an SU2 element essentially. Then the spin network states, we can define we can solve the kinematic, the theory at the kinematical level. Introducing good defined Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space of spin networks. So a spin network is defined by a collection of, we must define a graph which is a collection of edges on the spatial section sigma, and then a cylindrical function, which is a function from SU2 to ME to the a complex number. Then a spin network states is can be obtained as associating an holonomy or an SU2 element for any link or any path in the graph, and associating an intertwiner for any node in the same graph. The intertwiner is an SU2 invariant tensor, so these objects, or if we, the Hilbert space is characterized of all the possible objects of this type, and all the states that we build in this way satisfy the Gauss constraint. It is we can solve also the Diff constraint, and we can define the scalar product, which is defined which was defined by Hachetegard Lewandowski in very simple way and a different invariant way. It is essentially the integration of two cyclical functions with the higher measure. But this is not essential for what I will do.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is this already the step where your Hilbert space doesn't have a countable basis, or right now?
It's not a countable space. It's not separable Hilbert space.
But did you have a choice here? Could you have also tried to make a basis where your wave functions were a little bit more smeared up over the individual loops, so it would be like?
The connection is the function that defines the loops. It is integrated. Mm-hmm.
Just to address two things. When one mods out by the spatial diffeomorphisms and goes down to the spatial diffeomorphisms in brain states, the basis is separable, or the space is separable. When one finally, and B, there is no choice. There's a uniqueness theorem that says that if one wants an algebra of operators with the monomies and the electric flux, the exponential of the electric flux operators being bounded operators, and one wants a Hilbert space to start with, which carries a representation of the spatial diffeomorphism with no anomaly, then there's a uniqueness theorem and the Ashtekar-Levinsky Hilbert space is the unique one.
So does this kind of thing happen for some other wave theory as well? I mean, before I come out of the physical degree?
This is
general.
Yeah, so any diffeomorphism in variant gauge theory based on a compact gauge group, these results hold.
Compact or non-compact?
No, compact. Compact. And here he's using SU2.
Yes.
Okay, so then it's not a word, it's just like any normal theory then, as far as.
Well, except the diffeomorphism invariance makes the setting very different. Because without diffeomorphism invariance, one would be left in the original Hilbert space that he defined, which is non separable.
Okay. I wouldn't give all the details of the theory, but I want to recall what is a possible interpretation of those states. So from one side, we have spin network states. Then the topological dual of this spin network could be interpreted as a decomposition of the spatial section in a chunk of space. Why this? Because we can quantize two operators, the volume operator and the area operator and the volume operator, and the area operator has a very simple spectrum on the spin network states, and what we obtain is that for any nodes in this picture we have an eigenvalue of the volume, roughly speaking, and for any link in this feature, we have an area eigenvalue for the area operator. So a possible interpretation of the spin network is also in this feature the following. We have, for example, in this case, we consider this Rialov region. The volume operator eigenvalue is related to the nodes inside the region. The area of the boundary of the region is related to the links that cross the surface, also this one, in this case. So this is the physical picture that we can extract from this, from spin network states. What about the Hamiltonian constraint? This is a part of the Hamiltonian constraint, the Euclidean part of the Hamiltonian constraint. There is, in general, another part, and I will write that in a few slides. And the fundamental ingredients to quantize or to quantize this object is to define the inverse of the square root of the determinant of the density triad in terms of the Poisson bracket between the connection and the volume operator. This is a classical identity, but in this way we can define the Hamiltonian constraint, this is the classical Hamiltonian constraint, in terms of holonomies. And what we obtain is an expression in terms of holonomies, and also in terms of the volume operator that we are able to quantize. What is the action? This is the Tiemann definition of the Hamiltonian constraint. There are some problems, but okay. The quantum operator can be obtained replacing the holonomies with the operators, and in this case, the action of the operator on spin network states introduce exceptional ages near the nodes. This is the action of the Hamiltonian constraint. So The Victorian constraint is not solved on spin network states, but it defines the dynamics, or in general, this object inspired the construction of spin form models. But
can you repeat that? I didn't understand that statement. So you say you don't want to solve the Hamiltonian constraints?
The spin network states doesn't.
They are not solutions.
Okay. I'm not sure.
Is that the statement?
Yes, this is the statement. But the alternative define the dynamics, and so the dynamic could be defined in any case using the alternative constraint or engineer the spin form model.
What does that mean? The spin form model is supposed to give you a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint?
Yes, the physical scalar product
you
is.
You make a new theory based on a path integral.
Yes, the spin form model is a sort of path integral. And the physical scalar product that we can define considering the exponential of the Hamiltonian constraint, or the projector in general, is a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint by definition. But there are many things to understand.
Formally speaking,
both viewpoints you mentioned are aesthetic.
Okay.
We just start to discuss pure gravity. How much of this goes through?
Without, with matter. Okay, there are a lot of papers with many details about matter and loop quantum gravity on the same foot of the gravity that I explained here. So we can define in general rigorously also all this, the field in all the standard model in the same way on spin network states, and we can give for them an evolution, a dynamics. So it is possible in principle. There are other problem, but at the mathematical level, it could be fine. In a sense, you introduce the matter. It is not an unification theory as in other approach, like string theory. You introduce the matter, you quantize, you have a spin network with other labels, not just the representation of SU2, but you have also other labels. For example, the scalar field lives on the nodes of the spin network, and also the fermions, and you can define the
things like chiral anomalies and gravitational anomalies when you have chiral theories. Have people done chiral theories?
We cannot have a gravitational anomaly because we define the Hamiltonian constraint in this way on different invariant states.
I understand there cannot be, but still there are theories, meta theories that we know of.
This is a very key issue. So there are results which claim that the consistency of the algebra of the constraints is maintained without anomaly in including any coupling to gauge fields and fermions, including ones that would have chiral anomalies in the perturbative treatment. And
anomalies are non-perturbative.
Well, right. And that raises an issue which you're alluding to, and the issue is unsolved. I think the best conjecture is that chiral fermions double as they do in lattice gauge theory.
Okay.
But that has not been really completely shown.
Okay, now I want to apply the ideas that they extract from loop quantum gravity to try to solve the singularity problem in the black hole, for the black hole. In particular, what I want to study, and what also Arshtag and Lewandowski study, is the space-time inside the event horizon. So the idea is that inside the event horizon, the space-time is homogeneous, and it is a particular example of Kantosky-Sachs space-time, which in general contain two general functions of the time coordinate, A and B. So the singularity in this case is in B equal zero, if you calculate the Kretschmann invariant, or in capital T equals zero in this Schwarzschild form. Then, Let me introduce the connection and the density triad for the spherically symmetric problem and homogeneous in this case. We have the phase space parameterized by C and B, PB, and this is the complete version of the Hamiltonian constraint with the Euclidean part and the curvature part. And if you introduce this form of the Hasselbalch variables in the Hamiltonian constraint, we obtain this very simple Hamiltonian constraint. The Diff constraint and the Gauss constraint in this case are automatically satisfied because of homogeneity and spherical symmetry. And we can solve the Hamilton equation of motion, and we obtain the Vashi solution I have wrote before in the previous lines. So what is the relation between the Hasselbalch variable and the metric variable? The singularity is, I say, in B equals zero in the Kantorsky Sachs spacetime, and B is the radius of the S2 sphere in the Schwarzschild metric. So B square is PC in the Hasselbalch variables. Instead, PB square over PC is related to the anisotropy in the Kantorsky-Sachs metric. So we introduce the holonomy, like in the full theory. Those are our canonical pairs, and we consider, because of homogeneity, the holonomies on a particular graph or on particular graphs in the radial direction, in the phi direction, and in the theta direction. The length of the path in this case doesn't disappear because we have not diff invariants, and so we have this extra parameter delta, which is essentially the length of the path where we define the holonomy, where we integrate the connection. We can, and this parameter cannot be zero because the quantization that we will do is not weakly continuous in this parameter. So those are our variables, and we can express the field strain and also the Hamiltonian constraint, like in the full theory, in terms of holonomies. And we have an Hamiltonian constraint in terms of C, B, PC, and PB. Sorry, in terms of the holonomies of those variables. But the quantum theory, what is good defined is the holonomy, but not the coordinate.
Sorry, in your Poisson brackets, did you tell us what gamma?
Gamma is the emission parameter that we introduce defined in the Hasselbalch-Barbero connection. So it is an extra parameter at the beginning that we can fix, for example, from the black hole counting of states. What is an extra parameter?
Can you have some physical intuition for why there is this one free parameter in the theory? I mean, is there some physical intuition?
I think there is not a complete. Yes?
I mean, if you write very clean the first order formalism, it's just there's an extra term in the action that you can write. And this parameter is just discounting constant there. Now, this parameter doesn't affect anything about pure gravity, it might just affect the behavior. So you're able to frame it. It's not a classic thing. It's like a low energy effective parameter that you can put in the action, in gravitational action. But classically, it's very hard to find an observer.
Is it like a theta curve for QCD?
It's
a theory will make sense for every value of gamma, or you finally expect only one gamma to be correct after all it's taken into account?
I think it's not going to be certain. It's not.
You're saying black holes might fix gamma, so you're saying.
If you want A over 4, you must fix gamma to.
So somehow the full ultimate theory might want a particular gamma.
Yeah. I have an intuition for it, but from the outside, which people usually reject. suppose you have a theory with some fundamental discreteness, which you could argue whether this is or is not it. But if you do, there'll be a free parameter of order unity, which represents
the true discreteness scale ratio to the Planck scale.
That's like the log.
Yes, it's like exactly it, it's like that.
Because it is in front of the spectrum.
Well, isn't the Planck scale an emergent, at least, isn't it a derived property?
No, I agree with Raphael here. This is both what Laurent said is true, and this is also true.
So you can relate these discreteness scale with a bimodal reaction.
That is the spectrum of the area and the volume have gamma g bare g newton bare.
Okay, we're talking about the bare g.
The bare gamma doesn't affect the coupling to matter in the same way. So why it appears in that peculiar way is another question. But there seems like there should be a parameter of that sort somewhere. If we can view it as one that has a genuine discreteness at some scale, I mean, discreteness of some scale.
So, but you're also saying then that the G Newton I see there, that's the bare G Newton. I mean, the sort of the effect of low energy coupling or whatever gravitational strength, that's a different number that we have to derive.
Yes. For example, by computing the black hole entropy.
Okay.
There is a black hole slide that they have. I'm not expert on that calculation, but they have an
Ask slide. Okay, why don't we go ahead then?
So the quantum theory is defined by an L2 Erbor square, what is essentially important for to say about this Hilbert space is that the wave functions are normalizable on the inside the Hilbert space itself. And you can see this from the fact that we have the Kronecker delta here instead delta Dirac as usual. And the whole, those states are eigenstates of PB and PC. Mu and tau are the two eigenvalues. And so the singularity in quantum theory is in tau classically is in the the eigenvalue tau when tau is equal to zero. The volume operator is diagonal on those spherically symmetric spin network states, we can say. And it is proportional to L Planck to 3. Okay. At the kinematical level, what we can calculate is the spatial curvature, and R3, it is proportional to 1 over PC. Classically, the spectrum of this operator is the dashed line here. At the quantum level, we obtain for any value, for any representation J, this spectrum, and it is plotted in terms as function of tau, the eigenvalue of PC. The spectrum in black in this picture is bounded, and it is completely different from the classical one. For a small value of tau. It is in accord with the classical one for large value of the volume or of tau. We can study also another operator, which is the inverse volume operator. And here we have two pictures of the spectrum in terms of mu and tau. And we can see that it is regular for any eigenvalue of PC and PB. What about the dynamic? In this case, we can try to solve the Hamiltonian constraint because the model is simple. And so we must find the solution of this equation where psi is a superposition of eigenstate of PB and PC with the coefficients psi of mu and tau. What we obtain when we impose the constraint is a difference equation for the coefficients psi. And what we can say until now about the singularity problem at the dynamical level is that all the coefficients here are regular for tau equals zero. And also we have an evolution beyond the tau equals zero point because tau can take values for any value of R. We can have some problem when we try to solve this equation, because you can have some numerical instability if you don't choose the correct semi-classical state. But however, there are indications that there is not a singularity because the regularity of all the quantities that are here. But it is an open problem to solve this equation. And we cannot modify too much this equation. It is not an approximation of the differential equation. It is the difference equation that we obtain. So to modify this equation, we must modify also the Hamiltonian constraint. And it's not simple if we have some problem to improve.
But is this not, in the end, a discretization of the continuum, a particular discretization?
Yes, a discretization where delta couldn't be zero, the parameter that couldn't be zero. Essentially, it is not a Schrödinger equivalent representation of the Weyl-Heisenberg algebra, but this is mathematics.
But that's where the physics is getting in. So.
Yeah.
It's not just mathematics.
Yes. Okay, now I want to find semi-classical. I want to find the semi-classical solution starting from this particular Hamiltonian constraint that comes from loop quantum black hole. And how I define the semi-classical analysis? Okay, I take the same Hamiltonian constraint that we have quantized before, and instead quantized, we solve the Hamiltonian equation of motion for this Hamiltonian constraint. And also the Hamiltonian constraint must be satisfied, must be zero, together with the Hamiltonian equation of motion. So the Hamiltonian equation of motion for our variable are these, those four, and we must solve those equations with together with the Hamiltonian constraint. What we obtain is an analytical solution for C for all the variables in the free space, and without read the results, I give a plot of the solution. Okay, the dashed line is the classical solution, and the 2 points represents here, because the plot is PB as function of the log of PC. So essentially, in the semi-classical solution, we have not just the Schwarzschild horizon, but another interior horizon at the Planck scale, essentially. So the solution seems to be like the Reisner-Nostrum solution instead, that like Schwarzschild solution. But the event horizon here is 2 Hem, the 2 G Newton Hem, the Schwarzschild radius. Now I will have other slides, and I will write the metric in the usual form. Maybe it's more clear than here. So to put the metric in the usual Schwarzschild coordinates, we must exchange, but it is just a definition of the names of the coordinate, T and R, and also we must exchange those the anisotropy and the Laplace function. Because I find this solution inside the event horizon, then I want to extend the solution to all the space-time. But also if I don't do this, this thing is correct inside the event horizon. But I rewrite the same metric in the usual R coordinate, R and T coordinates, Schwarzschild R and T coordinates. Until now, I didn't do nothing. I didn't extend nothing. So what is the metric? Metric is this one. So it is very simple, I think, to read also. We have two event horizons. One in R plus, one in R minus, and I form this solution inside the two event horizon in the homogeneous case. And another particular thing that we have is that we have a bounds of the S2 sphere for as function of R for around the Planck scale. So the S2 sphere arrives to a minimum area and grows again. And this function appears not just here, but also here and in the Laplace function. The first horizon, R plus, is the Schwarzschild horizon. The other one is related to the delta parameter, which is the parameter I explained before. And A naught in the metric is the Planck area, the minimum R Planck area that we can fix in this metric using the full theory, but also using the mean superspace framework without use the full theory, and there is a difference of factor two. So this strong as a result. And what I want to do is to extend this metric to all space-time. Okay, I'm not able to solve the equation of motion in the non-homogeneous case, but I'm able to find a coordinate changing, like in the Reisner-Nostrum case, that remove the coordinate singularity in a minus and in a plus, and so analytically and mathematically I can extend the solution. And I can write the Penrose diagram. It is the correct solution also for the full quantum gravity theory? I don't know. But we can extend it analytically this metric.
What do you mean? You keep referring to the inhomogeneous case. What do you mean by that?
Sorry. Yes, I understand.
What do you mean by inhomogeneous? This looks inhomogeneous already.
No, this is homogeneous. Inside the event horizon, I have studied the homogeneous problem because the function, that the connection, in this case, C, B, PC, depend just on the time coordinate. Okay. Not on the air coordinate.
But on the metric you wrote down, that R dependence.
R is time. So the time invariant time translation becomes possible. Can I ask? So we were inside the horizon before, and we had a Hamiltonian that moved us forward in time. But those slices become null, sort of at R minus and R plus. But now you seem to want to go. I'm not sure how the Hamiltonian is now evolving you spatially.
We must consider, to answer your question, we must consider the non-homogeneous spherical symmetric Hamiltonian constraint. In this case, what I can do is just to extend the solution, but I'm not sure it's a solution.
We have the interior solution and we analytically continue the metric.
Why I do this? Because outside it is exactly Schwarzschild, so.
Okay.
Wouldn't say I believe, but maybe it's.
But that's what I don't understand. Schwarzschild is not homogeneous. So
inside the.
Outside. So you took a homogeneous thing and analytically continued it and got an inhomogeneous?
Yeah, I can continue analytically this metric.
He analytically continues a time-dependent solution to a time-independent inhomogeneous.
Yeah.
So he got it.
The classical solution. They calculate the solution inside, outside. In this case, I'm not able to calculate the solution also outside. And I hope the solution is the same.
Can you see that metric again once? Can you see that metric once again? So the time is taking me towards the singularity. As I evolve, so R is the time, as I go towards smaller R.
Here is R plus and here R minus.
That time is going away. So you start at the singularity and you evolve towards the horizon.
Yes, the home.
Right.
What is the problem? That I calculate the solution here.
The question is just what's the arrow of time? Is there an arrow of time in this?
An arrow? I did the Penrose diagrams. Maybe can I answer it as well?
So you're just writing the metric in between the two horizons?
Yes.
Yes.
Until now. Okay, what are the properties of this metric? I say that we have two horizons, but it is regular, for example. So what I did is to calculate the Kretschmann invariant in this case, And what we obtain, there another, okay, this one. What we say, if we calculate the Kretschmann invariant, the curvature scara, and mu neuro sigma and mu neuro sigma, we obtain this plot in black in this picture, and the dashed line represents 1 over R to 6, the classical curvature invariant, the classical Kretschmann invariant. So we see that the curvature invariant has a peak around the Planck scale in these units, and goes to zero in a smooth way for R that goes to zero. And I will back on this point. So I have another plot.
Where was R minus? Where we wrote
that? R minus is 2 ham times a function of delta.
No, but on your graph, it would have been somewhere under the peak, is that right?
Here is.
Yeah. It's not zero, is it?
This one? The peak. No, it's not zero. It's not
R minus is somewhere under the.
Yeah, L Planck. Around this point is order L Planck.
No, but R minus is somewhere along that axis, isn't it?
Okay, depends on the value of delta, where R minus is bigger than the peak. It's smaller than the peak, sorry.
Smaller than the peak, okay.
Yes, but depends on the parameter.
But so is the location of the peak.
Not in the location of the peak.
So the location of this peak does not depend on delta.
Not depend on that. Not depend on
that. But R minus does depend on delta.
Yes. Yes. This is a result. It's not here, but
but the location of the peak depends on L Planck.
On L Planck and just on L Planck. There is this picture shows this. It doesn't depend on the mass. This is important if you want to have a quantum effect just around Planck scale. So the peak depends just on the not on the mass, sorry, just on the Planck scale. So in this plot, there is a function of the Kretschmann invariant as a function of L and R. In this direction, we can see that the peak is around the Planck scale, but it is independent from the mass. It is the same for any value of the mass. We have two different imaging spheres at this point.
Mass of what? I don't
like. The parameter that I have introduced in the theory. So. The claim is that the black hole mass. So now, because we have this, we have seen that the equation is zero around R equals zero. What I did is to develop the metric around small R equals zero. Then we obtain this form. But if you do this coordinate changing, 1 over R, essentially, you obtain exactly a Schwarzschild-like solution. But what is the difference? The difference is that now the capital M that appears for an observer in L equals 0 is the inverse of the mass in unit. So we have a sort of duality, I don't know, between the infinite and the R equals zero point. An observer in R equals zero sees a mass or feels a mass which is the inverse of the mass that we see. So, okay, I want to write again at this point about the analytical continuation. Usually what we have about the Reisner-Nostrum solution are two terms, the logarithm of R minus and the logarithm of R plus. But we have not this term. So those two terms are able to eliminate the singularity on the two horizons. In this case, we have another logarithm term that essentially, not exactly, but essentially this term removes the singularity in R equals zero. This is the tortoise coordinate, the usual tortoise coordinate. It's very simple. We have just a difference in the coefficients. And it is an analytical result. We have what is the difference with the Reisner-Nostrum solution? Here we have the asymptotic region, R to infinity. We have the outside horizon to M. We have the inside horizon in the first Penrose diagram. And the second Penrose diagram is different from the Riedel-Nostrum, because in the Riedel-Nostrum case, we have singularity here. And r equals 0 is in this vertical line. Now we have this other asymptotic region in r equals 0. So this is the relation between the Riedel-Nostrum solution and the usual Riedel-Nostrum Cartan-Penrose diagram. And what I obtain analytically with all the coordinate changing, and it is not conjecture. If you believe in that metric, this is the Cartan-Penrose diagram. And so, how I say it, we have an asymptotic region for an observer that sees a mass M, and another observer in R equals 0 sees instead this dual mass, capital M.
So is that some kind of a singularity in some sense, this the dual mass? I was just wondering what happened to...
In N equals 0, you say? No, there is not singularity in this metric, I hope. Okay, the Kretschmann invariant is regular for any value of the radius of the the radial coordinate.
So do you, can I see here a closed trap surface with no singularity inside? I mean, I'm just thinking about singularity theorems.
I don't know if I understand correctly, but...
there is a horizon, right?
Yes.
So I can think of the horizon as some kind of a closed trap surface with all the light
coming
in. But there's no singularity inside that horizon.
Yes, exactly. There is no singularity in R equals 0.
So that's because the equations of motion are not the equations of motion of traditional gravity.
What I can say about this is that if you calculate the Kretschmann invariant and you look the Kretschmann invariant for small r, what you say is that it is something like r to 6 over L Planck to 2, I don't remember the power. So if you send h bar to 0, you obtain.
Because in that sense, there's still some version of singularity theorem. You just smooth it out by your quantum effects.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry. But more importantly, I think at R minus, I mean, you would have thought you were hitting the singularity in the vicinity of R minus, but that's where your quantum effects became important, right? Or your Kretschmann invariant it peaked around there, around the Planck scale, and then it started going back down to zero in this way.
So when you expect the singularity, you got this kind of bump instead.
You got a bounce, some kind of bounce because of the new framework.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what you would think about all singularities in this theory. That when you expect singularity, you sort of can go through.
Yes, that is what.
Do you know is this spacetime in JDS even computed?
Yes, I think. I have calculated the geodesic equation, and it is what you obtain is that the geodesic equation is can be solved until r equals 0, and an observer arrived there in an infinite time. So it is almost consistent.
It looks as if there would be, I mean, where the two asymptotic regions meet, you would expect to see a singularity.
The two asymptotic regions, sorry?
Well, in the diagram.
This diagram. The two regions are r equals 0 here. And
yeah, where it meets r equals 2L.
But maybe if we so this is the diagram in the dual coordinates.
This is the diagram that comes from the new metric, and this is the Riesner-Nostrum.
Oh, okay. So we're looking over there.
This one, sorry.
Yeah.
But Raphael's concern, where say I plus R meets the dotted line R equals 0, that sort of X right there might be problematic.
This line.
That point.
This point right here.
That's I plus. I don't know. R equals 0 means R equals 2L.
This is the infinity for an observer here.
Yeah, it's not problematic.
the two spheres all have infinite area coming from every direction. I agree, one wants to work very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that, but just
there certainly has to be thought.
Did you take any curves that approach that point? So,
you
say that?
The radial curve. I've studied that question very close to L equals zero. And so you have the proper time to arrive, infinite proper time to arrive there. Okay, I say that if you look the metric in the core for very small value of R, you obtain this sort of dual region in the space-time. But it is possible that it is a duality of the metric for any value of the coordinate radius. And in fact, it is there is a self-duality of this metric. And I find it together with Raymond Schwarz. Here and the duality is exactly this one. If you start from the metric I explained before and you consider this transformation, you obtain exactly the same metric. So you have a duality between small and large scale in this space time. And what means we are working on, this is a symmetry of the metric. So what about the thermodynamic? What I did is just to calculate the surface gravity and to extract information about dynamic, the thermodynamic from this one. So this is from Steve Jobs. So the temperature is the extrinsic the surface gravity divided by 2 pi. And if you plot the form of the temperature, you obtain the black line in the picture. It is regular and also in m equals zero. And instead, the Hawking temperature is the dashing line that goes to infinity for m that goes to zero. We have this form, for me, nice formula of the entropy, which is regular for any value of the area, and it has a minimum in the minimum area Planck. If we calculate the evaporation using this approximation, where L is the luminosity, the difference with the Hawking result is that now we have an infinite time in green here in this picture to have an evaporation. We have a sort of ramp. Not the remnant, but because we have an infinite time of evaporation. But in this approximation, right? This gap is order Planck scale. So we don't know if we can consider correct this evolution. Okay, now I introduce
the slide. A note in the previous slide was order h bar, right? So very small.
This picture.
Previous slide, though?
Yes. Because we want to see it.
That little A naught with subtracts are from A squared. The small, you know,
yes,
exactly. That's like order one Planck length or something.
Yeah, one A naught is L Planck square, etc.
Right, and so can I relate that to the fact that your smallest bit or whatever your way of thinking has a spin of 1 unit or half a unit? So, I mean, usually the angular momentum appears in that formula in the place where A naught square is appearing, right? In many kinds of
the angular momentum, the area spectrum,
yeah. this is the minimum momentum to subtract off in the same way. I'm just wondering if
this is the minimum area, is not the spectrum of the area.
That's an interesting observation.
I'm just saying that instantly what happens is that the way that things get cut off is that the smallest bit also has at least a half unit of spin. And the reason the sort of the throat of a black hole and all this ends is that that minimum spin you can't get rid of. And so you all, it appears the same way that the JS curve is subtracting it. Your minimum bits also have a half unit of spin in some sense, which not completely from you. I was wondering if that's really what's cutting it off in some more sense.
It's the labels on the spin networks are not related to angular momentum.
Okay, so they're completely different spins. They're not physical
spins. They're related to area. Yeah, it's the same thing as what you're saying. So you have a minimum area because your minimum possible area is one thing coming out with spin one half of it, which is the minimum.
Slides about other people can intervene at this point because I'm not an expert on the black hole entropy in the case of the food theory. And what is the idea is to consider an isolated event horizon in the food theory, and it is not related to the mini superspace approach. This is considering just spin network and a surface. You can say spin network and a surface. The surface is an isolated event horizon, then how the people calculate the entropy of this object. They count all the possible states that gives the same area. And then they extract the logarithm of this number. What that they obtain is this formula for the entropy that is not A over 4, because there are other coefficients. In particular, there is gamma, the Nielsen parameter. Then if you fix the Nielsen parameter to this particular value, this is related to the previous sequence, you obtain the usual A over 4 formula for the entropy. This is the leading order for the entropy. There are other calculations in number theory, it's very complicated, where they obtain also the log correction entropy minus one half the log correction of A over n squared L n squared.
And that comes out correctly. Once you fix gamma from here, then
yes, and also about gamma, we can say that if you consider a toroidal horizon or other black holes, a Kerr black hole, I think also a Challenger black hole, I don't remember, you take always the same parameter. This is the claim that I know. The same value for the parameter. However, it's about to work a lot.
What about the thing I was raising before about non-equilibrium black holes? Or about non-equilibrium horizons?
So, in this framework?
Yeah.
What could be the same? It's just a prescription, right? So you could just the same thing. It's just there's nothing that gives you this. You're just positing that you should calculate the entropy by counting the number of spin.
But it's in the presence of particular boundary conditions on the surface, which correspond to it being what's called an isolated horizon, which means that there's no matter there, nothing's going in and out, and therefore I believe that that's equivalent. I didn't hear what you meant by non-equilibrium, but I believe that's equivalent to being in equilibrium. Mm-hmm. And the whole setup, because in the case that you have such an isolated horizon, then the degrees of freedom on the, if you take it to be a boundary of the space time that you're studying, then the degrees of freedom are represented by a boundary theory, which is a certain kind of Simons theory on the surface. And what one is counting is the states of that transcendence theory on the surface minus punctures, where the punctures are where the ends of the spin networks reach the surface. So whether that would still hold out of equilibrium, I think is not. At least I don't know off the top.
Yeah, There's also another thing. Shouldn't you be computing these for solutions, counting states for solutions as a Hamiltonian constraint or something? I'm not quite sure how to put the question.
In this frame?
Yes.
I think it's there is not enough dynamics in this.
So this is a kinematical.
Yes, a kinema. Yes, it's correct. Somebody.
Maybe this was mentioned already, but again, should I think about it here as an entanglement entropy or as a microscopic
It is a macroscopic entropy.
Microscopic meaning really the number of states.
Yes,
rather than
exactly.
Just
that.
Of things that are
when it's cut out the interior,
yeah.
But what it corresponds, I mean, the easiest interpretation is microscopic because the variables, the Chern-Simon variables which characterize the space of states correspond to different ways that the quantum geometry can have certain degrees of freedom of curvature while the area is held fixed.
The Chern-Simon theory lived on the horizon, so you're applying
yes.
some kind of a logger.
Yes, it is a projection of the particle values of the two-dimensional surface. And you must impose a relation of density triad and connection. What do you obtain in Chern-Simon theory with group U1?
Let's be precise here. In this calculation, there's no need to refer to any conjecture about holography. What there are other calculations.
No, but you're not discussing anything regarding the criterion. At least you're just looking at it closely.
In that sense, yes. In that sense, yes.
Okay,
yes.
That was
one can play a similar. One can study a similar problem. If there's a non-zero cosmological constant on an outer surface, and is also a Chern-Simons theory that characterizes the outer surface, and then you can make conjectures about holography and bulk boundary
correspondences. Oh, but I was more talking about me to what extent you were assuming that there was still some bubble space associated with the interior space. That does not enter into the entropy, which is similar to the discussion earlier.
Right.
Whether or not this is purely entanglement or.
Can I just ask the question another way? I mean, can you have an arbitrary large spin network inside this region, which has, let's say, only a given 100 number of boundary lengths? Or are you saying that with only. Okay, so it's not like with a given number of boundary lengths, the size of spin network is bounded at that.
Yes,
exactly.
Kinematically, I mean, one can conjecture that if the dynamics is imposed, one could conjecture various things about the interior quantum geometry. But as far as kinematically, the interior could have an arbitrary volume for a fixed area.
So you could imagine, as we heard in the last lecture, it could be enormous, the universe inside, and all things are perfect.
Yes. Yes, but the work that he described, which is Leonardo's work, is able to address that question in the context of the homogeneous model.
Yes.
There is not work which addresses that question in the full theory.
Okay, unfortunately, I have to act more chair-like and cut off the discussion. But let's start by thanking Leonardo for his time. We have to set up.